Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Why do we speak and write the way we do? And is it reasonable to fear that our children's reliance on digital technology will diminish their ability to communicate? Linguist David Crystal isn't so worried. He's an honorary professor at Bangor University, and his latest book offers an introduction to the study of verbal and written communication that is engaging enough to appeal to tweens and teens and sophisticated enough to interest their parents as well. The book is called A Little Book of Language. David, welcome to Think.
Hello, Chris. It's a pleasure to be with you.
So you start this book really at the beginning, and it's remarkable how instinctively we seem to know how to teach babies language.
Yeah, it's extraordinary, isn't it? You know, the reason why I started at the beginning, and that means with birth, really, and the first sounds that babies make and how parents talk to them, is because you're absolutely right. I was writing this book in order to interest youngsters, teenagers, you know, kids 12, 13, and so on, as well as older people. And I was having to think to myself, now, how do I get young people interested in language? And the decision I came to was, they're always interested in people younger than themselves. Mm-hmm. They've all been babies. They've all seen babies. They've all interacted with them, probably. And therefore, I thought this is a good place to start, right at the very beginning.
It made me think when you went through what happens at 3 months and 6 months, and that by 9 months, you can actually distinguish what language a baby is babbling in, even if there are no words. I thought about kids going back and looking at all the old videotapes of themselves and looking for clues to this.
Yes, that's right. It's a fascinating question, isn't it? When can you actually tell that your baby is speaking English or Chinese or Spanish or whatever it happens to be? Now, at birth, of course, there isn't any difference at all. All the baby cries that come out then are absolutely the same the world over. And the same point applies when you get to about 3 months of age and the baby starts to do its little cooing noises and so on. You can't tell the differences then either. About 6 months of age, with all the babbling that goes on, the ab-ab-ab-ab, the ad-ad-ad-ad, and so on. Again, no real change here as you go around the languages of the world. But when you get to about 9 months of age, something really remarkable happens. The baby's vocalization starts to sound just that little bit like the language around it, or languages if it's growing up bilingually. So the rhythm is the first thing you notice. You know, one of the things about English is it's got this tum-ti-tum-ti-tum-ti-tum sort of rhythm. Mm-hmm. You hear it in poetry, you hear it in Shakespeare and so on. Well, by about 9 months of age, the English-speaking baby is starting to make its babble go tum-ti-tum. It's going bab-bab-bab-bab-bab-bab. Whereas a child growing up speaking, say, French or even Spanish is going to have much more a kind of rat-a-tat-a-tat-a-tat sort of rhythm like you get in those languages. And a Chinese child is going to be going up and down and up and down, reflecting some of the tones of Chinese. So that's when people say, hey, this kid is starting to sound English or whatever.
And even before they can make a statement or ask a proper question, the tone of their voice, even in a single word, will let you know what they're trying to communicate.
Oh, yes, that's right. I mean, intonation, the melody of the voice, is probably the first really distinctive piece of language that a child acquires. And there are probably reasons for that, but let me just illustrate it first. I remember it actually from one of my own kids, and I think I use this story in the book. My young son, Stephen, who's in his 40s now, but when he was very, very little, when he was about 14 months of age, he had learnt the word dada. And one day, I mean, I had the tape recording on record. Do you remember tape recorders?
Yeah, we have some of me when I was,
away,
yeah.
I had the tape recorder on all day. You see, I was tape recording everything my kid said. This is sort of getting some data for my research. And one day, he's in the evening, and it's time for me to come home. And he hears my footsteps on the gravel outside. And he says, da-da, with a kind of rising tone. And then I come into the room, and he says, da-da, with a falling tone. And then he reaches out his hand and he says, da-da, with a kind of beseeching, level tone. So what we've got here is da-da, a question. Da-da, a statement. Da-da, a command. So this is the earliest signs of the sort of primitive grammar that kids are using, thanks to their intonation.
I think it was always interesting with my own kids to notice that even when they made mistakes in their grammar, they sort of made sense. The mistakes were logical.
They are. I mean, what kids do is they are desperately trying to make sense of the world around them. And there's always some sort of logic there. I mean, when children start to develop their vocabulary and they learn a word like doggy, shall we say, or dog, and they look around and they see other animals, they see a little pussycat going past and they call it dog, and they see a cow and they call it dog. And they sort of overextend the meaning of the word to apply to anything that shares some resemblances with the first animal they saw. Well, there is a logic there. Of course, parents, noticing this, immediately start to correct it. They say, oh, no, that's not a dog, that's a cat. A dog goes woof, a cat goes meow. And they start to explain the difference. And so gradually the child's logic gets refined.
And we do this as parents without realizing that we're providing instruction.
Very natural, isn't it? Nobody teaches parents to do this. It's one of the most amazing things all over the world, in all the languages I've ever studied. You see exactly the same strategies happening. Nobody actually takes a parent on one side and says, now, parents, this is how you must talk to your child. No, there's something really rather instinctive about the whole business. For instance, take that sort of typical second-year conversation that parents have with their child. The child says, quite simply, a one-word sentence, car, shall we say, or dog, or something like that. Now, the parent doesn't just stop and say, yes, it is, end of conversation. No, that's not what parents do. Parents take the word and they build it into a sentence. They say, yes, it's a car. But then they don't stop there. They carry on. They amplify it. It's a car. It's a big car, isn't it? You like cars, don't you? And they go on and on, amplifying that little child utterance into perhaps four or five or more sentences of their own. Now, what are they doing there? They're basically saying to the kid, good kid, yeah, you just said a good word. Now, here are other things you could say about that word. Here are other horizons that you can move towards in your language. And slowly, the child, picking up on those cues, starts to develop those sentences. Parents acting as a teacher, in other words.
So let's fast forward a bit to the time when we're learning how to read and write. Why is English spelling so devilishly complicated?
Oh, yes. It's one of the big questions that every young child asks, too. I mean, when I was saying that I was writing this book for young teenagers, when I was doing it, I actually asked many teenagers, what are the most interesting or awkward or complicated things about language that you've learned so far in your 12 years of life? And this was one of the things that came up repeatedly. Why is English spelling such a pain? Well, the answer is, of course, it's all down to the fact that English has been such a successful language on the world stage. Over the past 600 years, if you think about it, English has been influenced by all kinds of other languages. In the beginning, the spelling wasn't irregular at all. If you go back 1,000 years to Anglo-Saxon times in Britain and the way the language was first written down, you find it was all perfectly regular. Well, one or two exceptions, but on the whole, a letter meant a sound, and that was it. And it would have stayed that way if things hadn't changed. Now, what changed? Well, 1066, for a start. Along come the French, and they beat up the English and take over. And what happens as a result of that is they bring in their French scribes who start to write down the language in a French sort of way. So whereas in Anglo-Saxon times, a word like queen was spelt nicely and phonetically, C-W-E-N, well, the French didn't like that at all. That didn't seem very French. So they respelled it as Q-U-E-E-N. And they started to complicate the spelling system. And then a little later, all sorts of other languages started to influence English, and gradually the spelling system got more and more and more complex. So fast forward 600 years, and you find a system that actually reflects the influence of dozens of different languages.
And then you have Noah Webster, and you have Samuel Johnson, and their dictionaries, and never again were British and American spelling much like each other.
Yeah, Webster's the only example of a successful spelling reform in the English language. Quite amazing. All hail to him, really, Noah. People have tried to reform English spelling right from the very beginning, really. As early as the 12th century, there was somebody, a man called Orm, O-R-M, who thought he would try and simplify English spelling so that people could, so that priests could give their sermons more effectively. And then in the 16th century, There were other attempts to reform spelling, but none of them succeeded. And people still today, of course, try to reform English spelling. There's a spelling reform society in Britain, and there's another one in the United States, and so on. But the only set of spelling reforms that ever succeeded were the ones introduced by Noah Webster, you know, round about the year 1790, 1800, and so on. And the reason for that, I think, is obvious, that this was a time when the new nation was coming into being, and Webster felt that a new nation needed a new language, and a new language meant a new spelling. Let's make the language different from the language of the old colonial oppressors. And because the mood of the country was so strong in that direction at that time, the spelling reforms actually took root. But since that time, nobody has ever done anything remotely like Noah Webster did.
Does it surprise you, David, that we are still such sticklers for things being spelled correctly? There are as many adults who struggle with spelling as children, and a lot of people say it doesn't matter. And yet, we all still try to make sure that things are done correctly, and those of us who notice sort of snicker when we see something misspelled in a public place.
Oh, no, I'm not surprised at all. You see, it's so important in language that we understand each other, that we speak clearly to each other and write clearly to each other. And for many hundreds of years in the early history of English, that didn't happen. You know, if you go to the very early part of the Middle English period, when just before Chaucer was writing, around about 1300, 1400, people wrote more or less as they wanted. There was no correct spelling then. People spelled words any old how. So a word might be spelled in 20 or 30 different ways. And as a result, it became increasingly difficult for people to understand what each other was writing. So slowly, the move for a standard English emerged. And by the time you reach about 1500 or 1600, that mood was very, very strong indeed. People were starting to realize the importance of having a standard spelling, just so that they could understand each other. And by the time you get to the 18th century, with people like Johnson and Webster writing their dictionaries, this mood was very, very entrenched. And it's been that way ever since. In other words, one needs a standard spelling system in order to guarantee intelligibility. If you spelt the words anyhow you wanted, Chris, and I spelt them anyhow I wanted, we ultimately wouldn't be able to write to each other. And with something like the internet, even though there's a great deal of variation on there, still, you know, 90% of the internet does actually use the same basic spelling. So it's an important feature of standard English, and it's very important that kids learn to spell, learn those conventions of spelling effectively. Otherwise, even though it might be cool every now and again to spell in some weird way, like you do get on the internet every now and again, but if you don't learn the standard system, ultimately there's going to be a breakdown in communication in society.
Now, you live in Wales, is that correct?
I do indeed. I'm speaking from right now from North Wales.
Is Welsh as difficult a language as it appears, at least to look at it on the printed page?
Well, I don't think so. But then, of course, I grew up with Welsh as a second language when I grew up in Wales here once upon a time. So I think the reason why people look at Welsh when they see it on the page or in a notice or something like that is that they don't notice a very important thing about it, and that is that Welsh has more vowels than English has. English has just got five vowels, hasn't it? A, E, I, O, and U. Mm-hmm. But in Welsh, the letters W and Y are also vowels. And so once you realize that a W is simply pronounced "uh" and a Y is simply pronounced "uh", then actually it makes much more sense and you start to decode Welsh in a much more straightforward way.
David Crystal is my guest. He's an honorary professor at Bangor University. His new book is called A Little Book of Language.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, languages, history, and communication start weekly in January. Details at smu.edu/think.
listening to an archive edition of Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is linguist David Crystal. He's an honorary professor at Bangor University and author of A Little Book of Language. So, David, we talked a little bit about spelling and the importance of knowing how to spell things correctly. A lot of adults are appalled to see the way their children are communicating via text. And this is not something that you are wringing your hands over as a sign of the downfall of Western civilization.
No, not in the slightest. People should not be worried about this. There's a huge mythology that's grown up about texting, you know, simply because it's all so recent and so novel. You see, if you ask people who are worried about this and you say, why are you worried? They will give you this answer. They will say, I'm worried because the texts that young people use are full of these newfangled abbreviations and they're leaving out letters so they don't know how to spell. Well, none of those points is true. Full of abbreviations? No, they're not. If you actually collect a big pile of text messages together, and any of the listeners now can do this, then you count up all the words in those texts, and then you count up all the abbreviated words in those texts, you'll find that only about 10% of the words in the text messages are actually abbreviated. And then the second point, these are all new abbreviations? No, they're not. If you take abbreviations like the letter C for the word S-E-E or the letter U for the word Y-O-U and so on, you find that these go back in English about 200 years. People like Lewis Carroll, you know, Alice in Wonderland, he used to use them. Queen Victoria used to play games with her children using these abbreviated rebuses, as they were called. And finally, the thought that kids leave these letters out randomly also doesn't turn out to be the case. I often go around to schools and I ask the kids, why do you leave letters out? And they say, because it's cool, because it's fashionable, because it's, you know, our way of doing things. Well, if it's cool to leave a letter out, you've got to know that a letter is there in the first place in order to leave it out. And so this makes the point that the best texters actually turn out to be the best spellers. And if you can't spell, you certainly can't text. So I don't think anybody's got any cause to be worried at all.
The other interesting thing is that the only words that really get abbreviated on a regular basis are the most common ones. Kids know how to spell the word C-S-E-E.
Yeah, exactly so. And people have to not trust the little dictionaries that you sometimes see in shops. You know, dictionaries of text abbreviations and so on, which have 1,000 abbreviations in them or something like this. When you actually look at those abbreviations, you find that none of them are ever actually used. They're all sort of cooked up by people just for the heck of it. I mean, kids do this all the time. So do we adults. We're always making new words and inventing words and playing with words. And kids are just the same. But the actual fact, the majority of these abbreviations are never used. And only the common ones, as you say, turn out to be frequent.
As far as regular dictionaries, you remind us that we should consider these to have an expiration date on them.
I'm sorry, missed that one.
Dictionaries that we buy, regular full dictionaries, have sort of an informal expiration date. They don't last forever. We should replace them.
No, they don't. This is one of the big recommendations I always make. You know, we change our cars every year sometimes or less. Every few years, we like to keep our cars up to date. But we don't ever check under the hood of the dictionary to find out exactly how it's doing. I mean, a dictionary that is more than 5 years out of date is really not a very good guide to how the language is changing. People don't realize sometimes how rapidly a language like English is changing. You know, 2 or 3 new words come into English every day. That's, you know, 1,000 or more a year. And senses of words change quite dramatically, too. So if you wanted to keep your language up to date in a way that you can, you know, check on what's going on, then you do really need to change your dictionary at regular intervals. I always get the latest edition of every dictionary just to see how many new words are coming in. And there's always a couple of thousand new words compared with the previous edition, even if that edition's only a couple of years old.
Why do some slang words, David, come and go in a matter of a couple of years, whereas others, and I'm thinking here of the difference between the word groovy and the word cool. Everybody uses cool. It doesn't feel like slang anymore. But nobody says groovy except in an ironic way.
No. Or daddy-o, I suppose. Remember daddy-o? Once upon a time. Oh, yes. I mean, slang is an amazing thing. It's always been in language. There's never been a language that hasn't got slang, and there's never been a period in the history of English that didn't have slang. And if you ask what is slang for, well, your listeners might like this little jingle, which I always use. The chief use of slang is to show that you're one of the gang. The gang means anything. It means a gang, not just in the street gang sense, but a gang of doctors or a gang of lawyers or a gang of journalists or a gang of anybody, you know, a group of people, in other words. Everybody develops their own slang. Now, the purpose of slang is to sort of unite the group, to make it bond, to make everybody feel they belong to the same little cluster of people. And as a result, it does tend to be ephemeral. It doesn't last forever. Some slang words last quite a long time. But what happens is this, you know, a group of people start to use a word, and it's nice and different and cool and fresh. And then gradually other people hear it, and they pick it up and say, I'd like to use that as well. And so they do. And as soon as that happens, the original group stops using the word that they started. I mean, a good example of this from a few years ago was the word bling. Do you remember bling?
Oh, for jewelry and, yeah.
You know, glistening jewels and all that sort of thing that young, especially African-American people were using. Well, it was very much used in that particular group, and then gradually other people started to use it and to extend it. And so the original group stopped using it. And the average life expectancy of a piece of slang sometimes is only a few years.
Does every language have swear words?
Oh, yes, though not every language has the same sort of swear words. Hmm. It depends on what you consider to be taboo in your culture, which are the swear words, which are the ones you're going to use. For example, a language which is very specific about a particular religious tradition is likely to find that the taboo words there are going to be related to that particular religion, whereas a culture that is not so religious orientated is hardly likely to use religious words as swear words. Around the world, you do find, you know, the parts of the body, the effusions that the body makes and such things are the most commonly used swear words. But even there, you get remarkable changes over periods of time.
Do we need them somehow? Do they have a social function?
Oh, they do. This has been studied several times. Everybody swears, even though people think they might not. But if you say just something like, you know, oh, crumbs, or oh, crikey, or oh, sugar, or something of that sort, and you think, I mean, that's a swear word, even though it's a very, very mild swear word. What is it that it is? What is it about a swear word that makes it so useful? It's a way of letting off steam. It's a way of letting your emotion explode without anything serious actually happening. I mean, think about it this way, Chris. What's the alternative? You encounter an unpleasant situation, whether it's you've stood on a broom and it's hit you on the head, or you just something horrible has happened. What are you going to do?
So instead of throwing a dish across the room, I just let out a four-letter word.
You can throw the brush through the window, and that's going to be expensive. You can hit the person that you don't like. That's going to be dangerous. That could be litigious. You could get a punch back. Any physical violence is likely to land you up in some sort of trouble. Whereas if you just sound off, then you feel a lot better. I mean, I do it. Everybody's done it. I'm sure you're on your own in a room and something horrible happens. Something drops on your foot. You feel a lot better after you've let go with an expletive of some sort. It's not harming anybody, but somehow or other, that kind of vocal effusion has made you handle the situation a little bit better. Same thing happens when you've got a group of people. People who don't swear so much are often rather appalled when they pass a group of people in the street and they hear them, you know, effing and blinding all the time. What appalls them is the different swearing tradition that is part of that group. Hmm. For the most part, the group concerned doesn't even notice that it's swearing, because that's just the way that group behaves. It's when you get two groups that have different swearing patterns that you get the tensions in society, because people notice the anxiety, the emotion that's in the other group, interpret that as aggression, and then get worried.
David Crystal is my guest. His new book is called A Little Book of Language. We'll go to the phones now and speak with Ian in Fort Worth. Hi, Ian.
Oh, afternoon. And hello to you, Taffy. Taffy for Wellspin, you know.
Oh, hello.
I wasn't expecting that from Fort Worth. I moved from Glasgow to Northern England at age 17 and very quickly picked up the local dialect, which you remember is quite distinctive, very different from Glasgow.
Absolutely.
Excuse me. And I've noticed a Scotsman who moved down to England after 20, in the 20s, did not seem to pick up the dialect. They remained the Scottish dialect. Does that indicate to... does that mean that you really lose the ability to learn speaking after 20?
Oh, no, I don't think so.
No.
I think the extent to which you pick up a new accent or a new dialect depends on a lot of factors. Depends on two factors, really. And both factors depend on what a dialect and an accent is for. Now, a dialect and an accent are both there to express an identity. They tell you who you are or where you come from. So somebody who has a very strong identity background, who doesn't want to lose a sense of their original roots, whether it be in Scotland or anywhere else, is likely to hold on to that accent regardless of which part of the world they end up in. On the other hand, nobody wants to be isolated in their new part of the world. So everybody is going to be influenced by the accent and dialect around them. Now, depending upon how much you want to become a part of the new society you've ended up in, so you will more rapidly pick up the characteristics of that new area. Now, most people are sort of in between the two extremes. Nobody wants to completely forget their background, and nobody wants to be completely identified with the new society. So most people end up with a kind of mixed dialect, you know, partly Scots, partly American, or whatever it happens to be.
I have an aunt from Boston, and she moved to a very different part of the country, and she said she has deliberately held on because she works in sales, and it helps people to remember who she is when she makes calls.
Yeah, that's a very good example. I mean, this is a functional use of identity. I mean, always these two factors are influencing us. One, where we came from. Secondly, where we want to be. And most of us sort of place ourselves on that spectrum somewhere or other.
And women, David, are a little bit more likely to change the way they speak to fit the group that they're in at the time?
Always, yeah. Women are always ahead of men in this respect. Women are always the prime movers. They're always the innovators with language change. This has been studied repeatedly over the years, originally, actually, with some excellent studies that were done in New York. And, I mean, why? Well, I don't know. Nobody actually knows why. Women tend to be ahead of men right from the very beginning with language acquisition. You know, we were talking a little while ago about children learning language, and all the kids are, in the first or second year of life, always learning the language at more or less the same rate. Well, by the time the children are three or four, you do tend to notice that girls are ahead of boys in this respect. Of course, the boys catch up later. You know, we're not that bad. But the women, females generally, do seem to have an edge as far as language learning is concerned. Maybe they notice things quicker. Maybe the famous multitasking ability of women compared with men is something that makes them pay attention to the diversity of language around them. I don't know what the reason is, but the fact of the matter is, you're absolutely right. The women are ahead.
You write here in the book about the received pronunciation that exists in the UK from the BBC. And in this country as well, there's sort of a what we consider to be an accentless form of American English.
Yes, or general American, yeah.
Yeah, what are those for?
Well, that's the kind of spoken equivalent of what we were talking about a little while ago when we were talking about spelling.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the main aim of spelling, having standard spelling, is to guarantee written intelligibility. Well, the main aim of having a standard accent and a standard dialect is to guarantee spoken intelligibility. A regional accent, a very distinctive regional accent, gets in the way. As the previous caller was saying, you know, if you come from some parts of Scotland, then the accent is so distinctive and so broad that you and I might have difficulty understanding it. Well, imagine an accent like that going out over the radio, over the BBC or anywhere. And what happens is that most societies evolve a kind of standard accent that most people become aware of very early on. Not necessarily that many people actually use it in everyday speech. I mean, the accent of the BBC is only used, that RP you were mentioning, is only used by about 2 or 3% of the population of England. But the point is that everybody has learnt to understand it. And so it gives a kind of unifying force to the spoken language of the nation.
And you write that nobody has really a single accent, that we can all, to probably varying degrees, change the way we pronounce words depending on who the audience is.
Yeah, that's right. Everybody does this, and some do it more than others. And it can be quite embarrassing sometimes when you meet somebody from a different part of the country. The important point is that you've got to get on with them. You've got to like them. You've got to be in rapport with them. And if you meet somebody from a different part of the country who speaks very differently from you, you're getting on well with that person, you will find that your accent starts to slip in the direction of their accent, and the opposite, their accent starts to slip in the direction of yours. It's called accommodation in linguistics. People accommodate to each other. Their accents sort of come together. The opposite happens as well. If you meet somebody who you don't like, who you're not getting on well with, you will actually make your voice sound different from the way in which they speak, and the accents will diverge from each other. Well, everybody does this. I'm always doing it. My wife tells me that when I answer the phone, she can always tell the accent of the person that's talking to me by the way my voice immediately slips into the accent. Now, I'm not doing it now, although every time you speak to me, Chris, my sort of feeling is I want to talk a little bit like you. And maybe there are some features of my way of talking which is being influenced by the way you speak. But on the other hand, I'm on the radio, and so I'm using a radio voice, which is not the same as my sort of everyday local Welsh voice that I'd used on the street here.
That's
your
grown-up voice.
Different accents. Mm-hmm. The different places you end up in make you speak in different ways.
David Crystal is my guest. He's a linguist and honorary professor at Bangor University. His new book is called A Little Book of Language.
Support for KERA comes from you, our members, and from
The Spa at the Crescent at Rosewood Crescent Hotel, offering an array of treatments for men and women. Christmas Day is approaching. Gift cards, treatments, and gift baskets are available online at rosewoodcrescent.com.
Bockendorf's, offering handcrafted designer jewelry and timepieces, including Rolex, Breitling, David Yurman, and Mikimoto, at the Plaza at Preston Center, the Galleria Level 1, and the shops at Legacy North. Distinctively Bockendorf's. Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, languages, history, and communication start weekly in January. Details at smu.edu/think.
Chris Boyd. You're listening to an archive edition of Think. My guest this hour is linguist David Crystal. He has just written a book called A Little Book of Language. David, as I know that you're aware, Texas is well known for having a handful of very distinctive accents, but it's come to the point that in the urban areas, these are not common anymore. Are we in danger of losing regional accents?
Well, this is a point that's made all over the world, really, all over the English-speaking world in particular, that accents and dialects are dying out. And it's true that some accents and dialects are. Remember what I said before, that an accent and a dialect is a reflection of an identity. And if that identity changes for historical or cultural reasons, then the accent and dialect will eventually disappear. Well, I have to say that when I was in Texas just last September, I was in San Antonio giving some lectures at the university, and I was listening like crazy to everything I heard around me. I heard lots and lots of stuff that I would consider to be, local Texan, and we discussed it a fair bit with everybody. But it is indeed the case that things are changing. Same things happening in Britain. Now, the question is, how are they changing? And one of the reasons is that they're changing because different ethnic groups are mixing the language in different ways. In London, for instance, there are now huge populations of people from various parts of India and Africa and the Caribbean and so on. And whereas the old Cockney dialect of London used to be the way everybody remembered London town and how it sounds. These days you're getting mixes of accents, you know, with Indian English and Cockney English mixing together to produce a new dialect and a new accent. So the old accents might be disappearing and some of the old accents are changing, but they're being replaced rapidly by new combinations.
Yeah, I was in Manhattan not long ago, and I was surprised at how relatively few New York accents I heard.
Yeah, but walk around Manhattan, and you'll also hear, you know, Chinese-American,
sure.
Spanish-American, Italian-American, and hundreds and hundreds of new variations, plus, of course, variations in age, with older people speaking a somewhat different style compared with the younger people.
You write here in the book about the fact that we've got about 6,000-odd languages spoken on Earth today, and half of them are in danger of extinction?
Oh, yes. Isn't this one of the most amazing facts of all?
Hard to believe.
Quite extraordinary. Yeah, 6,000 or so languages in the world, and half of them are at risk of dying out. I mean, there's a language dying out somewhere in the world, on average, every couple of weeks. It's as remarkable as that. Some of them are in the United States. You know, some of the older American Indian languages have very, very few speakers left, sometimes just, you know, one or two speakers. And when those people die, that language is gone. But the majority of the languages that are dying are not in North America. They're further south. If you go around the world, around the equator, and you go to places like Papua New Guinea and Indonesia, where there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of languages spoken, these are some of the areas where the number of speakers left is very, very small indeed, and the likelihood is that those languages won't last for much longer. Across into Africa, India, and South America, Brazil, for example, lots of Indian languages there, they're dying out. So although no part of the world is immune, the cumulative fact is that it is quite extraordinary. Half the languages of the world are likely to disappear.
What do we lose as a human race when we lose a language forever?
Well, we lose a vision of the world, really. I mean, no two languages are the same. Any listener to this program knows, who's encountered a foreign language or who speaks two languages or more than two languages, knows that the two languages don't translate into each other easily. You know, you do your best to translate from language one into language two. You're always coming up against words and phrases that don't quite match. You know, the French have a word for it, the Chinese have a word for it. You know that there are these differences. And some of these differences amount to a very different way of looking at the world, of perceiving the world, different ways of talking about things, of describing things. And this amounts to a different vision, really. And in some parts of the world, these differences are very, very important, completely different ways of viewing how it is to be human on a planet like ours. And so what's lost when a language is lost is this kind of unique take on what it means to be human for that particular culture.
Let's go back to the phones now. We'll speak to Craig in Nevada. Hi, Craig.
Hi. I just wanted to comment that here in Texas, if you want to show you're a Texan, you say y'all. If you go to a Chinese restaurant or an Indian restaurant, they'll come up and say, "How y'all tonight?"
Yeah.
And it's kind of a way of showing that they're Texans too.
Absolutely. This is one of the first things I noticed on my very, very first visit to Texas, which was way back in the 1960s. I walked into a shop, into a store, and somebody came up to me and said, "Hi, y'all." And I looked round to find the other people. And it was only me there. And that was the first time I encountered that one. And I'm pleased to say that when I was in San Antonio last September, that was one of the features that I heard most often.
Did you try it out yourself?
Oh, I most certainly did. I can say y'all like anybody can now. I'm a real native speaker of Texan, I think.
Next up is Marshall in Dallas. Hey, Marshall.
Hi. I am old enough to remember that 40 years ago in the Dallas area, there were discrete accents. And you could tell by listening to someone speak, if they were from, say, Highland University Park, which is a more upper-class area, or Garland, or Mesquite, which is more middle and working class. But you don't hear that anymore, or you would have to have an ear for it. And people just don't sound that way. But one thing I I have noticed, too, and this is somewhat different. I noticed that BBC TV shows, if they're made for American audience, you can understand what all the folks say. But if the TV shows are made for an English audience, sometimes we don't understand everything that the characters say. And I was wondering if you had any input on that, if how the folks in England sort of Americanize or somehow change the dialogue so that we here in America can understand everything better.
What do you know about that, David?
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? The movement of shows across the Atlantic does have quite interesting implications sometimes. I do know that that some shows have been, you know, redubbed, as it were, with a foreign audience in mind. But this is quite an expensive process, so for the most part, people don't bother to do that, and they just hope that the language is going to be sufficiently able to travel that it won't cause too much of a problem. I think it's not a symmetrical problem. I mean, we in Britain find it easier to understand American shows on the one hand compared with the other way around, and the reason is probably because of the dominance of American culture in films, movies, television shows, and so on over the past 50 or so years. You know, we have far more of your programs, I think, than you have of ours. And so most British people are very, very familiar indeed with, you know, the accents of the guys on Friends and things of that kind, compared with the other way. But it's not just a matter of going across the Atlantic, though. There was a program on British television a few years ago called Birds of a Feather, a comedy show based in London, where the two protagonists, the two girls, were supposed to speak a very broad variety of Cockney, London English. Now, when they made the show at first, the girls were so broad in their dialect that nobody even in Britain could understand them very much, let alone anybody abroad. And so the girls were asked to tone down their accents simply to make sure that the comedy worked. And I think this kind of thing does happen quite a lot. When you're making a show and you know it's going to be successful in a broader context, you tend to tone down accents somewhat.
And yet it does seem unlikely, no matter how much media and culture is traded between the UK and the United States, we'll never sound like each other.
Well, never. Well, at least only if something happened that is not going to happen. And that is if the two communities come back together again as a single nation, as it were. Remember, accent and dialect reflect identity. Mm-hmm. If there are two nations, there's going to be two dialects. That's the whole point. You know, that's what the language is there for, to enable people to express their identity in that way. And this is how accents and dialects change. As countries move towards each other, their accents and dialects and languages, of course, move towards each other. As they separate for whatever reason, especially if they have a war or something like that, it goes the other way. Good example of this happened in Yugoslavia just 20 years ago. 1990, there was Serbia and Croatia and Bosnia, and they spoke three dialects of Serbo-Croatian. And then there was a civil war, a huge war in the Yugoslavia territories. And eventually, Serbia became different as a country from Croatia, which became different from Bosnia. And now they speak three languages, Serbian, Croatian, and Bosnian, in only 20 years. And this illustrates the point that languages reflect politics. They reflect culture. They don't have an independent existence.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we will speak with Carol in Denton. Hi, Carol.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment about the different perceptions we have of maybe some well-known accents. I recently spent 6 months in Minnesota, and I'm Texas native, and they kept telling me that I didn't sound like I was Texan at all, and I felt like maybe their idea of what a Texas accent was more Southern instead of, and I grew up in North Texas on the plains, so I think it's that's closer to the Southwest than it is the Southern states, and I was just always kind of confused by that, I suppose.
Well, I guess we have a better ear probably for the nuances between different regional accents in the same area if we've been exposed to them all our lives. Is that it?
Yes, I think that's right. You know, recognizing accents doesn't come naturally. You know, it isn't easy until you've got experience of the area in question. And there's no reason at all why people in Minnesota should be instinctively able to recognize a Texan accent or accent from anywhere else, because how else would they encounter them? The only answer is, well, you know, through films and television and so on. And when you get somebody from a particular part of the country playing a part on where the character is part of the background, then almost always you get a somewhat intensified or somewhat almost exaggerated kind of the accent. I mean, so, you know, if you wrote a part for a Texan in a movie, you'd make sure that there were plenty of y'alls and all that in it, just to make sure that everybody got the point that the guy is from Texas. In actual fact, you know, ordinary people from Texas won't use those features as frequently as they're sometimes presented as being. And so along comes somebody who's a real Texan into somewhere like Minnesota, and everybody expects them to speak like a movie Texan, and they're not doing so. So I think it's probably something to do with that.
So, David, of the languages that are surviving and thriving today and will continue to do so, what are the chances that an entirely new language could evolve given the sort of global communication that we have today? Is that impossible now?
Oh, yes, it is possible. And it does sometimes happen. In fact, it's happening right now while we speak. The English language has spread around the world. It's a global language. It's spoken by 2 billion people around the world right now. And what's happened to English as it's spread around the world is that it's been picked up by all kinds of countries and cultures and then immediately adapted to suit their own environment. So if you go to Singapore, for instance, you'll hear spoken there Chinese, of course, and standard English, English you and I are speaking now, and you'll also hear a new language called Singlish or Singaporean English. Now, this is a mixture of English and Chinese and a couple of different dialects of Chinese, too, thrown into the mix. And if you and I were to go to Singapore, as indeed I was there a few years ago, I heard Singlish spoken. I could not understand it because there was too much Chinese in it for me. It was a completely new experience. So here we have a new language evolving out of the cultures that produce the dominant languages of that region. And this is happening all over the English-speaking world, and not just with English, of course. Some other languages, too, that are international are developing new varieties. There are not very many of these new languages, but there are a few.
Linguist David Crystal is an honorary professor at Bangor University. His newest book is called A Little Book of Language. David, it's been a fascinating hour. Thank you so much for spending it with us.
It's been a real pleasure. Thanks for your interest and also all from your listeners.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and y'all have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.